how to describe quantum operations and quantum noise. And the reference that I'm going to use for this one is, again, that textbook used for quantum information by Nielsen and Shuang. And this is all covered in Chapter 8, up to a few minor details and some changes of notation. Okay, so I want to come back to this picture of operational quantum mechanics that we spent the early part of this course developing, because we haven't finished the job yet, after a minor detour into infinite dimensional space, we'll come back and think about what's in the middle, transformations. And the reason we've left them is in part because what we're going to do today in looking at how we can extend those ideas of transformations from the initial view that we took, that they're all described by unitary transformations, to a more general idea that is based just around the probabilistic structure of experiments. When we do those general operations, we'll find that what we get sort of subsumes things that we would normally associate with preparations, and also things that we would normally associate with measurements. So this trichotomy sort of breaks down once we generalize things enough, because all of these different types of things merge together. In each of them, it's describing how a quantum system changes depending on what classical parameters you set for something about your interrogation on a system or its evolution, and what classical parameters you might get out when you're interrogating it and getting some measurement outcome. So all of these things will fit within the framework that we're going to start to develop today. And we had to make use of some, we'll make use of some things like entanglement. We'll have some side notes on infinite dimensional systems. So it was worth those minor detours. Okay, so it's we've already seen an example of when we move to this space of operators where we describe quantum preparations using density operators, and we describe measurements using POVMs. We're now working in this operator space. We've seen how unitary transformations work in that picture. It's quite simple. They just act by conjugation on the density matrix. Let's just, as way of another illustrative example to sort of motivate what we're going to do, let's look at how measurement acts as a transformation. Because I've avoided talking about this at all until now. So we've talked in this little picture about the idea that we have some preparation outcome, some state rho, and then we do a measurement. There's my quick little meter. described maybe in its simplistic way by measuring some basis. Not simplistic, but most limited way. And we've worked out things like, you know, what are the probabilities of different measurement outcomes, which for that particular measurement for a density operator is given by that expression. But we all have studied before the idea that we can measure the system and ask what happens to the system, not just what have I learned about the system, but what happens next. What comes out of this measurement box? You can see we're already starting to think of the idea of maybe measurement as a transformation. And there are many possible update rules that you could use if you wanted to just be axiomatic about it. You might say, oh, I have a model in mind, such as von Neumann's, about how that measurement is going to be done with interaction with an ancilla and so on, and I want an update rule that's going to match with that model. Or you might have just described measurement before in terms of projection and wave function collapse and say, I want something that matches that. So the standard update rule that people use that meets both those criteria is Luder's rule. That's the name we give to it. And it tells me that if I send in to a measurement a system described by a density matrix rho, that after measurement, after I do that measurement in a basis, that specific type of measurement, and get the outcome m, then I collapse the system. Whoops, what am I doing? I collapse the system to the pure quantum state corresponding to that measurement outcome. And that process occurs with probability Pm. Okay, so first thing to note, you know, this is certainly an example of a map that is not unitary. We have a very different type of transformation now. Unitaries are just one type of thing that can occur in a quantum experiment, and here's something else. Okay, it's hard to view that as a map on the system, but as expressed there, but maybe if I write it in the following way, it will be a bit clearer. I can think of that post-measurement state in terms of the pre-measurement state by thinking of acting on rho with these projectors on both sides. And then that doesn't give a normalized state, so let's normalize that thing. Let's divide by that. And then you can see that what I just wrote is equivalent to what's above just by canceling that middle term. Okay, so this, what I'm trying to do here is motivate a generalization through looking at this specific example. So I'm going to start to construct a framework which we're then going to generalize more and more through this lecture. So let's define something called measurement operators. So that's going to be a set M, which is just the projectors onto this basis, satisfying that they are a basis. So we have a completeness. Let me write it in this particular way. All of the reasons that I am writing things in this particular way are going to be clearer when we generalize. Obviously, it's a basis. I can just sum them to the identity as projectors. But I can write it this way as well. Then the map rho goes to rho m, which is given by this. This is expressing that same thing. Given that those are projectors, you're like, that's a weird way to express it, but it's expressing all that same thing in a way that's going to quite easily generalize. How do we generalize it? Well, first I can generalize it to more general types of measurements. We're going to generalize it to all types of transformations in a moment, but I can generalize it to more general types of measurements by noting that the set of operators given by M dagger M is a set of positive operators.
Is MM not self-adjoint?
This example, it is. So as I said, I'm trying to write an expression that will generalize. Okay. So in this one, it's not just self-adjoint. M's a projector, and so you keep saying, "Why do I keep squaring M?" It doesn't make any sense. It will make sense when we generalize. Okay. So these are a set of positive operators that satisfy sum over them is equal to the identity. So that means these things are a POVM. And so here's our first generalization. Given a POVM, with now elements EM, let's try to find a set of operators that now may not be projectors, that may not be self-adjoint, such that EM can be written in this form. Then rho mapping to rho m given by the same expression that we've been writing. Oops. I did that backwards, didn't I? That should not be there. Oops. Is that clear? Then this is a possible update rule. For describing that measurement. Okay, so let's just wait. I've written down a lot. Let's back up and think about what we've done here. We looked at projective measurements in a basis. We figured out a nice update rule. This is Luder's rule. It matches with a bunch of different notions that we've had for measurement in a basis before. Well, describes the Stern-Gerlach experiment and so on. I wrote it in this particularly weird form using these measurement operators, which are just the projectors into that basis. By writing in this standard form, I'm given a hint as to how I might be able to take a general POVM, which might not be expressible in terms of projectors, but nonetheless, find a set of measurement operators. Now, here's a bit of terminology. These M's are measurement operators. The elements of a POVM, despite the fact that POVM is doing a measurement and they are operators, we don't call them measurement operators. M's are measurement operators are the things that I put together in this way to get POVM elements. Often the terminology used for these guys are effects, measurement effects. If we put things together this way, here's a potential update rule that will produce the correct probabilities for measurement under the Born rule as given by the POVM. What's down here in the bottom, we can use the cyclic property of the trace to note that trace of PM rho PM M dagger. Did I say P? M sub M rho M sub M dagger is equal to the trace of EM rho, and that is the probability of the measurement outcome. POVMs, as we've built them, all they do is tell you the outcomes of the measurement. They don't tell you what happens after. But I could try to say, well, maybe I want something that looks analogous to what happens with projective measurements. And here's a potential analogous construction that I might use. Now, it relies on you finding some operators M that satisfy this relation. And you can see that that's definitely not going to be unique. For any set of operators M, I could act with some unitary on the left and get a new set of operators that also satisfies this condition. So it's not giving me a unique update rule. It's giving me a whole class of update rules for POVM. I can pick measurement operators corresponding to different update rules that lead to that same same statistics, but different post-measurement state. Okay, that may sound a bit unsatisfying. I just sort of motivated it by trying to draw some analogy with some weird form that I put the projectors in. So that's unsatisfying. Let's try to do something a bit more systematic and constructive. We're going to try to do that for all possible operations, and we'll sort of derive this whole formalism here for updates of POVMs in terms of measurement operators as a special case. Just one more aside, if I can squeeze it in here at the bottom. If we were to, so this is describing a measurement. I learn what measurement outcome occurs, and the system is then updated according to this map. If I were to forget the measurement result, or maybe there's some fault in my experiment. I say the measurement device did the measurement, the system came out the other side, but you know, the meter reading was broken and I couldn't read what result it gave. I say, well, I don't know what came out the other end. I have an ensemble of possibilities. I can figure out what are the probabilities of the measurement outcomes, knowing the fact that I did this particular POVM, but I don't know which one occurred. So how would I describe that update map? I would just take a weighted sum over all the measurement outcomes of the probability of those measurements and the density operator according to that measurement. I would construct a mixed state, and I would find that this is the simple form of just m rho m dagger. So in our attempts to try to generalize this and this POVM, we want a framework that also includes something like this. Something happens where maybe I didn't measure the system, maybe the environment interacted with it a bit, but sort of effectively measured the system, caused some decoherence. I don't know exactly what happens. I need to describe what occurs as some ensemble of possibilities. I need to have a framework that includes that type of thing as well. So that's what we're going to do today. We're going to try to construct a more general framework that will then reproduce this type of thing as a special case. But I think you see now how in going from this picture back here of transformations as unitaries to more general things, the range of possibilities is actually quite huge. Okay. Right, so here's the sort of the overarching approach that we're going to take. There's actually three different ways of generalizing quantum operations. So let me write down the three, and then we'll sort of compare what they are. So one is one that's quite motivated by thinking of the original axioms of pure states, unitary evolutions, and projective measurements as sort of fundamental, but saying, oh yes, but I want to describe massive systems, including the rest of the universe and things going on outside my lab. And I want a description for subsystems of that larger picture that is sort of closed under all the types of things I could do. So that picture is the idea that I have a system, why can't I spell today? System coupled to an environment. And what do I mean by environment? I mean anything else, other types of quantum systems. I imagine that I have a framework for quantum theory, and now I want to talk about what's just going on in some subsystems, and I should be able to think of the general operations of what occurs to that subsystem as being describable in terms of a larger, complicated interaction with a bigger system. So that's one approach you could take to building more general operations. Another is that we could do a bit more of an axiomatic approach. We constructed the space of density operators by just basically allowing ourselves all the possible preparations that we can imagine that are just consistent with the rules of probability. We constructed this notion of POVMs by just saying, what are all the measurements you could do that are consistent with notions of probability? Let's say we could do the same thing with operations. What are all the types of things that could happen to a density matrix that's consistent with the rules of probability? It's another approach you might use to construct these general operations. And then third is sort of the most useful one, but one that doesn't have a good motivation in terms of these other two. It just turns out to be practically quite useful, and that's really what we sort of saw on the last slide. It was an example of an operator sum representation. So this is not really so much as an approach as a framework that gives you the technical tools for actually doing a calculation. So what's quite remarkable is, so certainly in terms of the idea of a system coupled to environment, and everything is really in a pure state of the universe, and all we have is unitary transformations and so on. The surprising thing is that although that sounds like a very different starting point than the axiomatic approach that I just gave, we can prove that these two things are actually equivalent. And we can do that by relating both of these things to this operator sum representation to show that there's a nice formal framework for describing all quantum operations in terms of this operator sum representation. It describes all possible ways in which you could imagine a system coupled to some environment. It also is the complete way that you can describe all things satisfying a bunch of axioms based only on probability theory that we're going to write down. And it provides the bridge then to show that no matter what sort of interpretational framework you take or perspective you take on quantum mechanics, whether I want to view it really as an axiomatic theory with some just rules of probability applied, or I want to think of sort of the conventional notion of pure state quantum mechanics just describing a whole universe and consider subtheories of it, that these things are equivalent. With, of course, some caveats as to the actual interpretations of your results. All of these things will make use of the idea of a quantum operation expressed in our language of density operators as a map that just takes some density operator rho and gives me a new rho prime. And I describe that map. So this thing is a map from operators on the Hilbert space. Satisfying some properties that we'll investigate. So, yes, rho's now an operator on a Hilbert space. E is a map. Let's just leave it at map for the moment. It's going to take operators to operators. Sometimes people refer to those types of things as super operators, not to give them any special status, but simply to make sure when people are remembering what space they're talking about operators acting on, calling them super operators just helps to distinguish them. You know that they're acting on a different space than what you've been calling operators. So it's just notational. I won't use that language, if I can. Okay. Mm-hmm. So any questions on the approach here? So what we're going to do is we're going to wander around this way. We're going to start looking at describing things using the sort of standard pure state rules and unitary evolution of quantum mechanics that we know. We'll look at how we can describe general operations in terms of coupling to an environment. We'll then show that this operator sum representation, which you can define independently of that, can nonetheless be shown to be equivalent for anything in this representation. I can find a system in a coupling that gives it. For any system in a coupling, it will have an operator sum representation. And then finally, we'll come to this axiomatic approach. And then we'll show that with a couple of axioms, you can basically reconstruct the operator sum formalism. And therefore, it's equivalent as a set of axioms to this notion of coupling to an environment.
So is this all related to this thing that you can express a measurement by making a unitary evolution of our system followed by a projection?
Yes, so that will be a special case of one of the general types of operations that we're going to consider. So the idea of doing a projective measurement on a system that updates the system by Luder's rule will fall within this formalism. But so will doing more general types of measurements, noisy ones or weak ones. So will the idea of the systems just interacting with its environment and getting noisy and losing its quantum coherence. That will also fall within this type of formalism. In fact, anything that you can imagine within the quantum formalism is going to be expressed in this way, that we'll even be able to express in the end what we mean by a preparation, the full set of measurements, and everything else all within this framework. So it's quite powerful. Any other questions? Okay, you're keen to get into it, so let's do that. So we're going to start with this picture of interacting with the environment. So we have a system. Its initial state is rho. We have an environment with initial state rho e. And then your first question is, OK, well, we're trying to describe some system interacting with an environment. What is the environment? How big is it even? What is the Hilbert space of that environment? We haven't even asked the question of what is the dimension of that environment? Does it have to be infinite dimensional? So how large is this environment? It could be anything. We will restrict, just for simplicity today, to looking at finite dimensional quantum systems, including finite dimensional extensions to environments. But the framework generalizes pretty straightforwardly. So it could be anything you want. It could be a whole bunch of coupled harmonic oscillators or anything. But for general operations, for a completely general operation, it needs only be to be greater than or equal to the square of the dimension of the system Hilbert space. We'll come back to that later. That's not a straightforward thing to prove. So that's one of the last things we'll show. For the moment, just say, pick environments. Let's look at the range of type of phenomena that we can get. So we're going to imagine our system and environment in an initial state, rho tensor rho e. OK, that's a very strong condition. We're positing that at the start of the operation, the system and the environment are in a product state. They're completely uncorrelated. Now, that almost never happens. However, we're trying to describe a piece of the dynamics. The idea that we should be able to just describe a time step of evolution, a bit of the interaction of a system and its environment relies on us making some assumptions about prior correlations and so on. We're going to make this assumption for the moment, but keep in mind that that's not the most general type of thing that you can describe. When we really talk about what is the most general dynamics possible, then you really have to think about extending the range of that map right back to whenever those systems that were going to start to interact might be uncorrelated. If they already have developed some correlations through interacting, then you're not going to be able to describe a general evolution of that system without in some way referring to that past correlation. So that's I want to emphasize that caveat. That's a big constraint on the formalism. We're trying to be very general here, but there are many situations in which you're trying to describe evolution between a system and environment when they're initially correlated, and we're not going to be able to say much about that. Okay, so we're going to have now some unitary coupling U on the system plus environment. And so let me define now what I want. The advantage here is that all the steps of what we've done and what we're trying to describe are things that we've already covered within our formalism. So we've introduced density operators. We know what this product state of density operators is. We know how to describe unitary transformations. They act on, that's a unitary on the combined space of the both. And then now we want to say, well, we don't care about the environment now. We just want to talk about the system. So we have a mechanism for doing that as well. We're only interested in what is the state of the system. So we take the partial trace to calculate the reduced density matrix of the system by tracing out the environment.
Are we considering also that the system state and the environment, initial state could be mixed?
Okay. Yeah, so as it is written there, rho e, that's that can be a mixed state.
All right.
What we'll see is you don't need to assume that it's a mixed state. Well, actually, it's sort of obvious even at this step. We can say something about this. I haven't constrained the size of the environment. I've just said it's anything I want. So if we had a situation where your environment state is mixed, let's just make the environment bigger, such as to do a purification of that mixed state. And then we have a pure state. And we'll just not interact at all with any of that purification. So we'll be able to get the same dynamics. So this is a very standard way of viewing how these maps from these quantum operations are written. We think of extending the system to bring in something else, an environment, doing a large unitary, and then discarding the environment after that process to get just the evolution on the system. That's the interaction with the environment perspective on what a quantum operation should look like. So from this approach, you would say, I posit that the space of maps, E, that describe quantum operations on my system are ones where there exists some environment, some state, rho E, some unitary coupling to it, such that this expression holds.
Measurement device,
Hamiltonian
environment.
So we'll come to measurement, but we'll find examples of this where the effect on the system is it looks like that the environment is measuring the system. So it's not quite describing what we've talked about in terms of quantum measurement yet. Because you notice it hasn't given us a measurement result. So you can think of maybe, in some sense, the environment's doing some sort of measurement on the system, but not, but it's not reproducing the Born rule as we presented it. So that's the framework of interaction with the environment. It posits that maps take this form. That's a nice picture to have, but it's not technically very useful. It's like what is that space of maps? It's even hard to sort of characterize well, I have to think of all possible, you know, extensions. What are the all possible environments and their possible states in the set of all unitaries? It's not clear how to describe those maps in a compact way that should be, in some sense, independent of that environment. That's what the operator sum representation gives us. So what I'm going to do is derive the operator sum representation from that perspective of coupling with the environment. Then we'll get this representation. We can take that as a definition, which then we show is equivalent to that coupling with the environment. But we'll have a nice compact description that's much easier to work with. OK, so before even telling you what it is, let's derive it. I mean, I'm trying to highlight that alternatively, I could just define the representation that we're going to derive and then prove that it's equivalent to the coupling with the environment picture. OK, so let's put some caveats on this environment. Let the environment, which I'll call E, be finite dimensional. Let's choose an orthonormal basis. EK for the environment. Let the initial environment state, well, I can just write that. So E be the first element of that basis. OK, I've taken a restricted case so far of coupling with the environment. I'm considering an initial pure state of the environment. And I'm also fixing the dimension to be finite dimensional. Let's look at what this map that we just wrote on the last screen, what this map looks like when we include that pure state. Okay, so we have rho tensor the environment state, which is E naught. So this is rho on a system, E naught on the environment. We're going to act with U on that. And then we're going to take the partial trace over the system, over the environment. We can do the partial trace now that we have a basis for that environment, just as sum over k, ek, ek. And that can be written as a sum over operators. Where I've defined those operators as follows. You notice that these are operators on the system, Hilbert space. So I've taken a unitary that acts on the system and environment, and I'm just now looking at components of it in this basis of the environment that leads not to a number now when I evaluate that bracket, but to an operator on the system. So here's the question. What properties does the set of EK have? Satisfy. Let's think about it as we're defining a map through the sum of operators on a density matrix. let's think in terms of, well, it's got to map a density matrix to a density matrix. If we want E of rho to be a density matrix, we want, one, that E of rho is a positive operator. And just by inspection, you can see that that's going to be true. We've taken a positive operator and acted on it with E's and the adjoint of E. We also want E of rho, sorry, we want the trace of E of rho to be 1. So if a state rho is a valid density operator, it has to have trace 1. So we want trace of E of rho to still be a density operator. That should have trace of 1. We can evaluate what is the trace of this expression. That's a trace of sum over k, ek, rho, ek dagger. That's just using the cyclic properties of the trace. I didn't want to take it outside. So we want the trace of this thing to be 1 for all matrices, all positive matrices rho. The only way that we can have that condition be true for all rho is for this operator to be the identity. So this expression should start to look familiar from that investigation of measurement operators. We call this the trace preserving condition. So we want quantum operations to preserve the trace of the density matrix. If we start off with a valid density matrix with trace 1, we want to end up with a density matrix with trace 1. And that will be ensured if we have this relation, that these things sum to the identity. So we call that, you know, the trace preserving condition. So we've shown from, you know, derived this operator sum representation from this coupling from the environment. But now if we wanted, we could just take this as a definition. A map E. Equals, given by E of rho equals sum over k, ek rho, ek dagger, is a quantum operation if the sum over k, ek dagger, ek is equal to the identity. What we haven't shown is that if we now switch to this definition, that that's equivalent to the coupling with the environment scheme. We sort of, maybe the coupling with the environment scheme just derives special cases, which just happen to have this form, but there's other conditions on them. We're going to show that that's not true. Yeah?
So in this definition, you are defining quantum operation, right?
So I'm trying to come up with three different definitions for what is a quantum operation, and then to show that they're all equivalent.
Yeah, so you want to say that every quantum operation has this?
Yeah, did I write it very clearly? Probably not. So this map, a map is a quantum operation if it can be expressed in this form with operators satisfying this. Maybe I should have written it that way. Yes. So a map E will be a quantum operation if it can be expressed as E of rho is this sum where those operators satisfy that, if there exist such operators that allow you to do that. So if we took that as a definition, is it clear that we could get any environment state? We'll come back to that. So if you were just handed a operator sum representation, how should I interpret that from the perspective of, oh, I want to think of things in terms of a system coupling with the environment? There is a natural picture that allows you to do that. Consider coupling to an environment. But rather than just discarding the environment, we're going to then subsequently, after it couples to the environment, to the system, subsequently measured in the basis EK. Following along with my description before of how I would describe coupling to an environment, let's just do the same steps. Let's take some rho, let's couple to an environment, let's make it in this pure state E naught. Let's interact them with some unitary. But then rather than just discarding the environment system, which involves taking a trace over it, let's actually project it in the environment, that is, perform a measurement following Luder's rule that we introduced of this system environment combination. You can just see by inspection that this is equivalent to just one element out of that operator sum representation. Oh, sorry, what I'm missing is I still have to then, if I wanted to make that identity, I still have to take the partial trace of the system after I've measured it. So let me fix that up. So I couple the system with the environment through the unitary, and this is going to be just proportional too. I measure the environment, and now I say, what's the system state of the system after I've measured the environment? It's given by just that one element out of my operator sum representation. I said it's only proportional too. If we wanted to normalize, we'd get rho k is EK rho EK dagger. The probability of this outcome occurring is just given by the total trace of this expression. So the ensemble of outcomes is represented as a density operator given by the operator some representation. So let's just take a moment to say what you should take from this and what you should not. It's providing a mechanism for interpreting the operator sum representation and the particular terms in it. It's saying, imagine this process that I've coupled to the environment, but rather than just then immediately discarding the environment, throwing it away, I imagine measuring that environment. The environment got coupled with the system. There were some correlations there. Measurement on the environment informs, provides information, is correlated with that of the system. And so in some ways, I can think of that really as an indirect measurement on the system. I'm learning something about the system because I knew it was correlated with the environment. I measure the environment. I infer something about the system, which I haven't directly measured. And then you say, okay, well, that's a good model for measurement, right? That I couple the system with some environment, which is actually my measurement apparatus. Then I measure the measurement apparatus. I learn that outcome K, and that tells me out of this way of viewing the final state of that transformation, actually there's one element corresponding to that one, EK rho, EK dagger, which corresponds to the actual outcome I got. And then there it is as a normalized state. If I get the outcome K, that's the state it was in. And how I should look at this thing is, oh, well, it's in one of those states corresponding to the environment having measured it, in a sense. And I just don't know which one. And you're like, OK, what's the problem with this measurement problem thing? It seems pretty clear. Yeah, OK, well, I have to have a mechanism in that where that outcome can come out of the environment for me. But at least I have a framework for saying, oh, I have an ensemble of states corresponding to the different possible measurement outcomes. It really is in one of those states, and I don't know which one. The problem with that is exactly this ambiguity of mixtures that we've seen before. That if I write an ensemble of states, you can get yourself into big problems if you say, I really want to think about it as it's being in one of these states, and I just don't know what it is. Because there are other alternative decompositions, other alternative ensembles of completely different quantum states that can lead to that same density matrix. We'll see later that that there's an ambiguity in this operator sum representation, that there are other representations for the same map that correspond to imagining doing a different measurement on the environment. Then you get a quantum state, which is an ensemble of completely different states for different measurement operators, fk, fk rho, fk dagger. And you can't have it both ways. You can't say, oh, I want it to be an ensemble of these possibilities. It got measured. It's one of these things. I just don't know which. And it's also an ensemble of these possibilities, because those can be completely inconsistent. So yes?
Wouldn't it have been more natural to use m's instead of e's, given your previous notation?
Yeah, good point. M is really leading you to think of a measurement outcome. I've tried to sort of reserve M for, I have an interaction with a system that maybe involves an environment, but there's a measurement outcome which I'm going to learn. And I can then do things, conditional on that knowledge that I've learned about the system. In this one, what I want to emphasize about this operator sum notation is, though you can look at it and you might say, oh, I want to think about these as measurement results, and I'm just summing over the range of possible measurement results. I just don't know which one occurred. I'm saying that there's some pitfalls with that perspective, and that Maybe by using the index K, we're not burdened by thinking of there's some particular measurement that actually occurred.
I guess that's
what I'm trying to emphasize here is this is a good picture for starting to think about questions of quantum measurement, and we're going to discuss it more, but at the moment, you should not directly say, oh, I can look at a quantum operation as basically it's just a generalized type of measurement, that there are certain definite values of K, and I just don't know which one. You can't do that any more than you can assign definite values to the different outcomes in a Bell experiment without getting yourself caught in some serious trouble.
My worry is more about the E rather than the index K. The fact that you used E makes it look like an effect.
Yeah, that's okay. Good point. I'm following the notation of the text there, which does use E for both things. And of course, E is used for the environment. So it's one of those things where you don't realize how bad the notation can be until someone points it out. Let me know if it's ever unclear. I mean, it's too late to change it for this lecture, but maybe I'll fix that up.
So can we clarify the relationship then between those E and M, if they're not, as you say, we can't interpret this decomposition as like a sum over measurement outcomes? In what case could we, and like how?
So we'll come to this. This is a long story. This formalism, I mentioned this a few lectures ago, is that formalism will allow you to incorporate aspects of quantum measurement, but there is a key deficiency here in that you cannot derive out of the assumption of I have pure states in unitary dynamics and some interaction of systems with environments. I cannot derive from that the Born rule and the fact that we actually get some measurement outcome. So this framework is enticing for making you think that we're partway there to understanding a way forward by saying, I can think of how a system interacting with its environment and then observation on the environment can somehow tell me about something about the system, but I'm still stuck a bit with this idea of this ambiguity of mixtures and these different possible ensembles. So there's an additional question of when can I actually say there is a specific measurement outcome recorded. The system has actually collapsed under the Luders rule into some particular state of that form. I really can view those things as measurement operators. When can I do that? Well, you can do it axiomatically by positing that there's a different type of thing called quantum measurement, which is completely separate from interacting with an environment. Or you could add something to your theory. You go beyond quantum mechanics and say, well, okay, what actually occurs here is that the universe splits into like many worlds, and one of these outcomes occurs with certainty in each of those worlds. And there's other approaches yet. You could use ideas of decoherence to say there's actually going to be some preferred basis in the environment, which provides a preferred ensemble which to decompose this state. And you say that's the one where a measurement has definitely occurred. But all of those things, I should point out, they go beyond the strict notion of quantum mechanics as written down axiomatically. And for that, we have to posit that a measurement is a different process than you can get out of from coupling with an environment with unitary evolution. That relationship should be enticing, but still leave you a bit uneasy at the moment. And we're going to come to that more in tomorrow's lecture. Any other questions on that? Okay. So, was there something? I want to just reiterate that word of warning about how it can look like, oh, this is completely compatible with a measurement picture, but that idea of ambiguity of mixtures and the fact that we'll see that there's some ambiguity in the operator sum representation, or I should say there's some freedom in the operator sum representation, is a word of warning. Okay, let's look at a specific example. We're going to look at amplitude damping because it's a bit of a non-trivial one. Consider a two-level system. So you can have amplitude damping for any size system, but let's restrict our attention to a two-level one. It's got an excited state. Are we back? Except we have a red pen. Okay, so a two-level system. We have an excited state, which is, one, and a ground state, zero, under some Hamiltonian, which we're not going to use in this description. Here's the process we want to describe. If it's in, let me just say it, and then I'll write it out. If it's in the excited state, then there's some probability that it's going to transition to the ground state. But if it's in the ground state, it doesn't change. Gamma is going to denote that probability of transitioning to the ground state, zero. Let's try to construct a model for this process by saying there's going to be an environment, and let's couple to the environment in a way that might reproduce this process. So let's take a qubit environment, two-level environment. Initially, in the zero state, and then we're going to model the process as we want an arbitrary state of the system, and the environment in the zero state to evolve as follows. Okay, well, let's think through state by state what we want to occur. If the system's in the zero state and the environment's in the zero state, we want that component to stay as it is. Right? If the system is in the excited state and the environment's in the ground state, then with probability gamma, we want that to transition to the systems in the ground state, the environment's in the excited state. And with probability 1 minus gamma, we want that state to stay as it is. So we've got to write that as a process on pure states using a unitary coupling to the environment. So instead of probabilities, we'll take amplitudes, and I'll take square roots of gamma and 1 minus gamma. And write it this way. For that component, the 1, 0 component on system environment should map to something with still a 1, 0 component, but that should occur with amplitude 1 minus gamma, square root. And then there should be now a 0, 1 component. That's where the decay has actually occurred, or the damping's occurred. And that's with amplitude root gamma. Yes?
Why do we want the environment to go to the excited state?
That's just an interpretation for what's going on in the environment. I mean, it's basically going back to this type of description we had before, is that if the system's going to stay the same, the environment can stay in its fiducial state. If the system's going to change, then we need to take the environment to an orthogonal state. I mean, otherwise we're not going to be able to write a linear map. So I gave you sort of an interpretation of an environment with a ground inside its state, but you can really look at this as, I've just picked a basis for the environment. All I need is two states. I have a fiducial state. It stays in that state. If the system stays in its state, and it transitions to an orthogonal state if the system is transitioning. So the choice, there is a degree of freedom in the choice of basis for the environment. That is this degree of freedom we're going to see in the operator sum representation. So this through the process we've just done leads to a quantum operation that acts just on the qubit state of the system with operators given by the following 2x2 matrices. And again, at the risk of overinterpreting specific elements in the operator sum decomposition as, oh, here are two things that could have happened and I just don't know which, keeping in mind the problem of ambiguity of mixtures, it is illustrative to think about what these two processes separately mean. This one is precisely describing that transition of an excited state to a ground state. And this maps the ground state itself to zero. And this one is, you know, a process describing what happens if there was not a decay. And thought of probabilistically, it makes you sort of think, oh, if there's no decay, then nothing happens. Why is it not the identity operator? Well, you sort of say, I have a system that might decay. I don't know if it's in the ground or excited state, but that system might decay. I've waited a certain amount of time. It hasn't decayed. I would actually use Bayes' rule to update my knowledge about what I think the state of the system is. If it hasn't decayed during that time, I actually think it's less likely to have been in the excited state than I thought prior to that process. So you have to do a bit of a change in amplitude even when you have that process corresponding to no decay, reflecting the fact that did I say that right? I may have said the exact wrong thing. I did say it right. The amplitude of the excited state gets decreased as a result of the fact that the decay hasn't occurred. You now are updating your knowledge about the system and say, oh, there was no decay. If I didn't know initially, if I said it was equally probable of being in the ground state or excited state, if it hasn't decayed after a while, I say, oh, I think it's going to be more probable I find it in the ground state if I measure it. Okay, how are we doing on time? We did start late, so let me keep going, though I know you guys are probably getting exhausted. What I want to just finish off with today, we're not going to get to the axiomatic approach, so we'll see that tomorrow. I'm going to first show that we can, I've shown that you can take the coupling from the environment picture and derive an operator sum representation. Then I said we could define an operator sum representation as just a set of operators that satisfy a certain constraint. Now I'll show that we can derive a coupling to the environment picture from any operator sum representation. And then finally, we'll just look at that degree of freedom in that operator sum representation. Okay, so just two more slides. Bear with me. Let's drive the coupling to the environment from the operator sum representation. So let's start with some set of operators such that they sum in this way to the identity. Now we're free to just, this is just an abstract representation. It's just operators on a system. There's no environment yet. So what we have to do is just make up an environment, create one, and show that we can create one that's compatible with that picture. So we're going to choose an environment with dimension equal. I want the dimension of the environment equal to the number of possibilities for k, so the cardinality of that set, right? And then I'm going to pick a basis labeled by k. And this includes the initial state, E naught, just like we had the state had before. Define a U. I'm leading you to believe this is going to be unitary, and it is. But at the moment, let's just define an operation satisfying the following. I want U to act on any quantum state of the system, but the state E naught of the environment. And I want it to act on that and map it to the following state. I want to define this map for all states on the system. Okay. Note that for any two such states, the inner product is it's going to be preserved. I'll drop my subscripts if you don't mind. Okay, dagger EK. Using the fact that the thing sum to the identity, this is just going to be, psi phi. So this mapping preserves the inner product. That means we're basically going to be able to find a unitary map on the whole space that restricts to this when you act just with states of that form. Okay. Then U can be extended to a unitary operator on the system plus environment. And then we have trace over E of U for any state now. Is equal to what we wanted, our original operator sum representation. So this is good if you really like that picture of all of this density operator stuff and so on. It's fine, but really I want to think of pure states and unitary evolutions and sort of the original most constrained axioms of quantum mechanics. Here we've shown that with the operator sum representation with very I mean, it's just a single constraint on what those operators are. It's describing a wide class of phenomena. And you might be worried that there might be things within quantum theory that are not going to fit within that framework, that can't be sort of naturally extended to some unitary dynamics on a larger pure state. But this really says that you can. Okay, you can always make that picture. So it's a nice self-consistency there between those perspectives. Any questions on that?
So the dimension of the environment is K, right?
Yeah, we just made up an environment. Well, sorry, yeah, like whatever the number of values of
so
K
what was
is.
So what was the relation? You also said that the dimension of the environment is
has
bigger,
to be larger or equal to D squared.
D squared.
Yeah. So we haven't proven that yet, but that will mean that there will always, for any operator sum representation, there will always be an equivalent one using the degree of freedom that we're about to explore that has a number of elements at most D squared.
Okay.
But yeah, we haven't shown that yet. That's going to be like one of the last things we show tomorrow. Okay, so let's just do this last thing today is show that freedom in the operator sum representation. So what we really have is a question, can two different operator sum representations be such that the resulting quantum operation for one is equal, it's harder for me to draw a script F, than to the quantum operation for the other. Do we ever have two representations, but it's actually the same process? And the answer is yes. So let me illustrate how this can come about. I'll give you a theorem, and I'll leave it for you guys to check out the proof of that theorem. Okay, so in the coupling with environment picture, there was a degree of freedom in there that we haven't exploited yet. I mean, there we said, imagine take a system, put it in a pure state, do a unitary evolution, and then just discard the system. Discard the environment. If after that unitary coupling between a system and environment, we did anything to the environment, like as in a unitary transformation on the environment, or even if we just change the basis that we're using for the environment, that's equivalent, then that will lead to a different operator sum representation. So let me show you that. A final unitary on E. Or equivalently, a change of basis of these, you know, we chose this EK. If we had just done a change of basis of that, picked another basis, that changes the operator sum representation, but not the quantum operation. So we'll have two different operator sum representations that lead to the same quantum operation. Let's sort of see how. So EK, if you recall, we define that as this. Let's define a different set, FK, which is just the same unitary, the same basis, but now let's just squeeze in here identity on the system, tensor, some unitary on just the environment. Those guys should lead to the same quantum operation, but this operator will be different. How will it be different? Well, let's work this out. Let's just, put in a resolution of the identity. putting in EJ, EJ. And that is just sum over J. Those things will just be the coefficients in some basis of a unitary matrix, U prime KJ, F, and sorry, and then I recognize those final terms are my original EKs. So where is this unitary acting? If we just go back to the operator sum representation, we don't even have an environment. Where is this unitary acting? It's like a unitary acting on just the space of labels of my operators. Okay, so it's a bit weird if you don't think of an environment of being there, but there exists an environment where I could extend it. There's one basis state of the environment for each of those labels, and that unitary is acting on that. Get a question?
Is that EJ?
Yeah, thank you, EJ. Okay, so let me just give you the theorem. So I've given you an example of there is a degree of freedom in the operator sum representation. Now we want to show that that is the full degree of freedom. So
the resulting operation will be the same,
yeah,
but the implementation different.
It depends what you mean by implementation. The list of operators that defines my operator sum representation, it will be a different list of operators. It's in many ways similar to the ambiguity of mixtures. I have two different convex decompositions of a mixed state into pure states. It's the same density matrix. If I wanted to think of the density matrix as corresponding to, oh, it's definitely in one of these states, I just don't know which one, then I'd have to be careful because there's an alternative. Similarly, if I wanted to think of a process E as in an operator sum representation, one of those elements EK acts, I just don't know which one, I'm in that same problem with an ambiguity of mixtures. Here it's another ambiguity in that unitary degree of freedom. It's representing the fact that interaction of the system, if I want to think of it as a measurement and recording some result, there's a completely alternative, different basis measurement that has different results and a different decomposition of the same system. So two maps will be the same if and only if there exists an M by M unitary U prime such that let me write it exactly as I've written it before. FK is equal to sum over J U K J prime E J. And the one thing you should just be careful of is sometimes you have two representations and even the number of operators in the representation is not the same. And then you're like, oh, they must be different because there's no unitary that relates them. Well, no, you just have to pad out. Smaller sets with zero operators. So whichever of your two operator sum representations has the most number of elements, pad out the other one with a bunch of zero operators, such as the same number of elements, and then look for a unitary that relates the two. Yep?
When you were rotating the bases, the EK bases,
yep.
You rotated the EKs, but not the E0. Right?
Yes, because it's the order of events is sort of going back to this picture that we're going to prepare the same state, we're going to apply the same unitary, and then we apply this unitary U prime on the environment alone. So here I think of not as a change of basis, but as an active dynamics on the environment, which will not change the system. And so in this expression, there is no such unitary occurring. This one, there is a unitary occurring. In some sense, they're describing different physical processes on the system plus environment. But then if I look at the resulting map on the system, I know that they're going to be the same. Because when I trace over the environment, the effect of that unitary is gone. In terms of a system environment process, it's not just a change of basis, it's actually a different process. But in terms of just the system map itself, and therefore, yeah, it's the same, and therefore we still have that equivalence. It's getting late, guys. I'm happy to stick around for more questions. The theorem of that, it's in the text by Nielsen and Schwong, or maybe Aggie's listening. She'll be inspired to get you to work out some details or something at some point. We'll come back to this tomorrow and look at that axiomatic picture, and then we're going to further interrogate these weird properties of what is quantum measurement. How can we make it fit into this formalism, if at all? So see you tomorrow.